Oh, I don't know what it's like for you all to be here at the first full day of a first retreat at our Insight Retreat Center. But I get this impression that whatever's going on in the inner life is so much more important than the fact that this is a first retreat, first day, new retreat center. I don't know if that's true, but that it feels to me like as if, you know, you all are practicing as if you're on retreat, and the various things that happen to people on retreat are happening to some of you. And that whatever that is probably much more important than this momentous event that was first day of a first retreat of a new retreat center. Who could care less about that, given that I remember, you know, for it was a long period of time when I went on retreat, where I would always begin my first day would always have a headache. That was just what happened. And because it happened so much, after a while I got kind of easy with it. Okay. This, you know, the first times I thought it was a crisis. And then I saw just, that was the pattern I had when I went on retreat. I'd get a headache and I tried to interpret it. One of the interpretations I had was it was decompressing. Somehow I was busy and active, and the transition from being busy and whatever I was doing to stopping, you know, either short-circuited in there or somehow that transition. And what was very nice for me was not so much that they eventually went away, which was nice, but before that, while I still had them, what was nice was the sense, the ease, or the how relaxed I became about having it. I didn't have it; it wasn't a problem anymore, and that was such a contrast to the dire problem that it was, you know, in the beginning. And that's happened with me in a lot of you know, over time. I'm a slow learner, but over time I've learned that a variety of things that happen on retreat and outside of retreat, that I don't need to take them so personally. I don't have to ride them so closely as if this is going to define the rest of my life. And learn to hold things more lightly, easily, softly, not take them so personally. I have an expression which, for a particular kind of, it's not unique to me, but there's, I like the expression, the delusion of permanence. And my form of the delusion of permanence is to think that the mood of the moment, this is it. I'm going to be this way forever now. And, of course, I don't believe that. I mean, if you asked me, are you going to be this way forever? I would say no. But the feeling, the kind of the way that my mind holds it, my mind isn't as smart as I am. So my mind holds it as if, this is it. I'm going to have a headache forever. Or I'm going to, whatever. It's kind of, that's kind of the way sometimes I've gotten caught with whatever's happening. It's getting so involved in it. One of the interesting aspects of suffering is that suffering generally involves being complicated. There's some kind of complicated thing going on when we suffer. It doesn't have to be that complicated, but it's more complicated. The situation is more complicated than it needs to be. So in that sense, it's complicated. A fair amount of suffering arises because of our interpretations, the stories we tell us about what's going on. And so we're adding to the situation a story, an interpretation, a commentary, then we get caught in and we live inside of. And it's possible to have something happen and not have a story about it. It's just what's happening. And, you know, we can make bigger and bigger stories. And some stories have big hooks on them. Because we have responsibility in our lives, or We imagine our future, and so we get pulled into the stories if they're really important. But even if the stories are important, they're still, sometimes it's the stories, interpretations that give birth to our suffering. Sometimes it's our wanting and our not wanting, which gives birth to our discomfort, our suffering. And chances are that the situation doesn't require as much wanting as you have, or doesn't require as much aversion or resistance as you actually have. And the desire and the wanting is added addition on top of the situation. So that's, we're complicating it in some way. And so it goes. So part of the path or the process of mindfulness practice, if you're interested, involves becoming simple. Not simple-minded, but simplifying ourselves from the unnecessary complications we add to the situation. And it's a huge task to do that, because some of the ways in which we complicate it, we don't even know we're doing it. And we don't understand the assumptions, beliefs, desires, feelings that we're operating on. And so it takes a while to kind of see them, understand what we're adding on top of them. So, for example, in my early retreats, I didn't realize how much I was straining in order to get concentrated. And so I was making it more complicated than it needed to be, and I just, somehow it was invisible to me that I had this strong desire to get concentrated, like I was measuring myself, my personal identity was tied up in being someone who could get concentrated, and I was comparing myself to others and who were practicing there as well, like I had to be as concentrated as them. And so it took actually quite a while for me to kind of learn to pay attention enough or see clearly enough to see what I was adding in terms of this trying to do. And part of it was benefited, part of the, I don't know if benefit is the right word, but part of what helped me to see was when I got to see clearly how painful it was to be wanting this so much, how painful it was to be caught with it. And I only saw it because I kept trying and trying and trying. And there are times when I haven't suffered very much, but as my mind gets quieter and quieter, very still occasionally in retreat, I've also seen a subtle operating of little assumptions, like the grass is greener somewhere else. Like there must be another experience which is better, another experience which is the experience to have. A subtle attitude like, this can't count. This can't be the right thing because I'm having it. Or whatever, you know. Some kind of a constant subtle doubting going on in my experience. It's all complication. It's all complication. And it, these kinds of things. And to see it is part of the wisdom process of Buddhist practice, to see what we're doing, to see how we get caught, to see how we resist, to see how we interpret. This is kind of one of the main points of Buddhist practice. The earliest teachings of the Buddha, when he talks about wisdom, he talks about wisdom from the point of view of being able to see how we do these things, to see how we complicate our lives, see how we add this extra stuff on it. What's interesting is he does not say that when you get enlightened that you'll see the true nature of reality, or you'll have some big experience that's really the experience to have. He puts aside any kind of positive claim about what you're going to get and have. But rather, he points to, when you get enlightened, you'll understand the nature of clinging, the nature of resistance, nature of stories and getting caught upness. And I found this, you know, in some ways it's kind of dissatisfying to have that as kind of an ultimate message, because you would think that, you know, you want something big, right? You want something you can show your friends, and, you know, and see how wonderful it is and profound it is. But as I've kind of done my own practice, I can't get away from how profound that is, because I find that every time I try to have a positive statement about what the point of practice is, it kind of trips me up a little bit. One of my favorite positive statements that I feel very kind of fond of is peace. I've had very beautiful experiences of peace in my life. They've been very meaningful for me. Some of them I had before I started even practicing. Some I've had in practice. And I think they've changed me and been important for me. So I don't want to knock them and say they're not important. But when I hold them up as being the point, especially as a teacher, I'm supposed to be teaching this stuff, you know. So sometimes I feel like I have to tell people, you know, why this is a good idea. And so it's a good idea because you can attain peace. That seems good, right? But I just can't quite sometimes say that, because to say something positive like that, then there's a thing there that is an obstacle. It's like something which clouds the air. I mean, the air, if you have pure, clean air or pure, clean water, you kind of can't see it. And as soon as you want to point to something in it that you can point to and say, look, there's a thing there, you've clouded the water, you've clouded the air. You know, if you really want to keep your air and your water clean and pure, you don't want to have anything in it. And you want to know how to get rid of things that are in there. You want to just leave it alone and not add anything. So a free mind is in a kind of beautiful way is a mind that doesn't have anything in it. Not because it's, you know, stupid or just turned off, but there's something about a clarity of mind, clarity of awareness that happens. That you don't even want to call it clarity, because then you're looking for the clarity. It's kind of like trying to touch your right elbow with your right hand. You can't quite do it. So I keep coming back to this, the wisdom of mostly talking about understanding how we get caught and learning how not to get caught. Learning what's clinging and then letting go of clinging. If you say, I'm no longer clinging, say there's no longer smog in the air, then that's, you're not looking for the smog anymore. But then you understand something, and if the smog does comes back, you know something about, you recognize it and see it. You can maybe do something about it. So to understand how our mind works, to understand how we get cling, how we get caught, is, I think, a very mature thing to do, because it teaches us how to then live more wisely when we do get caught. We learn to see it, we learn to work with it, we learn to free ourselves of it. If we have a positive statement about what this is all about, let's say it's something like peace, and you attain that peace for a little bit, you can have peace accidentally. You know, you can give yourself a lot of credit for being peaceful. But you can get peaceful without any wisdom, without understanding the process of what brings that peace. And I've known people who have had beautiful experiences in meditation on retreat, and they've gone back to the next retreat, and they've tried to re-experience the same experience, have the same thing. And I've seen meditation casualties around this effort. It's, you know, I've done my best. I didn't literally take them by the shoulders and shake them and say, don't, you know. But, you know, I've said politely, nicely, I don't think this is a good idea, and this is not how it works, and, you know, if you have expectation, try to experience the same thing over again, you're going to probably just suffer. But occasionally people just, you know, it's hard being a teacher, because sometimes people don't listen. And so I've seen this casualty. I've seen people just be miserable and really feel bad about themselves and angry about their retreat because it didn't measure up. It was supposed to be this experience. If the point of retreat is not to have an experience, but to become wise about how your mind operates, how you get caught, and how to be free, then that's portable. That's something you can take with you. You learn something about how it all works, and so then you can perhaps in the next retreat, you don't have to have an experience, but you bring with you that understanding about how your mind works, so you don't get tripped up or caught in the next retreat. And then what needs to happen or what can happen maybe it looks different than peace. Maybe for that retreat, rather than being peaceful, you spend the retreat dwelling in feelings of love or loving kindness. And that's the quality of the retreat. Or another, you know, there's all these different kind of qualities that can happen or experiences. Who knows what they're supposed to be? What I felt was very significant experiences at practice for me and retreat and outside was not attaining anything special, but rather feeling at ease about being ordinary. Just ordinary, alive, breathing. Just nothing has to happen, nothing special. I wasn't anybody special. The experience wasn't special. But that was special, just that ordinariness, just to be there. It was special for me because I lived in a mind that was concerned with extraordinary things, being an extraordinary guy or something. And so to finally just be ordinary, it was just a relief and just how nice and peaceful. So to let go. So part of the process of mindfulness is a big part of it is self-discovery, understanding yourself, understanding how it works. So much so that I like to say that, you know, don't take it too seriously, but I say it, you know, this is one of these, teachers sometimes make grand statements to make a point, not because they're always true, so. So I'll make one of those. Meditation begins when you're having trouble with it. Isn't that quite a statement? Your meditation only begins when you start having trouble. Now, of course, that's not true, meditation, but it's a nice thing to keep in mind that when you are having trouble in your meditation or your retreat practice, that rather than seeing it as a problem, say, oh, okay, now this is where really I get to start working, I get to start looking, I get to start trying to understand what's going on. Or I get to try to understand, how do I free myself from this freedom, from this difficulty? How do I, you know, make it less complicated? It could be as simple, I mean, I don't know if it's simple, but it sounds simple. You know, one of the common experiences in the first day of retreat is physical pain. And I've seen the difference between relating to the pain through being my pain and my self-pity and my, you know, disappointment and my ideas, all about me, myself, and I. And then just leaving the pain be just the pain. Be really, really simple with it. And that difference between identifying with it and imagining kind of the delusion of permanence, and this is it, and I have to fix it, and this is terrible, it's ruining my retreat, and all these complications. And I find that if I just relate to it as the pain, rather than my pain, or it's a lot easier. So make that simple movement. The headache, rather than my headache. The, you know, whatever it is. Sometimes that makes it easier. So to learn how to do that, to learn what we do, learn that we add this little extra thing of personalizing it, identifying it, making it mine, or measuring ourselves by it. So a huge part of the beginning of practice is discovery, self-discovery. And part of the process of self-discovery, that one of the things helpful is what is these practices the Buddha called the four. So usually in English it's called, translated as the four foundations of mindfulness. And it could be translated as the four areas for establishing mindfulness. And there are four particular areas of our psychophysical life that are particularly useful to pay attention to if what you want to do is become free. Sometimes when mindfulness is taught here in the West, it's taught in a beautiful way as being mindful for whatever is happening, kind of choiceless, open awareness to whatever is happening in any of the sense doors at all. And that's a very freeing way to practice that way. But it's not how the Buddha taught mindfulness. And so I'm not saying one is better than the other, but it's just interesting to see the difference. So it's the impression I get from the ancient teachings is that there were particular areas of our life which are particularly useful to focus on if what you want to do is become free. And so it's particularly useful to pay attention to your body, It's particularly useful to pay attention to something called the feeling tones of your experience. And then it's particularly useful to pay attention to the state of your mind. And then it's particularly useful to pay attention to what I like to call the truths. The word is dhamma, dharmas. And so these are considered the four foundations of mindfulness. Of these four, the one that gets the most press, gets the most teachings and the most emphasis in this discourse the Buddha gave in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, was mindfulness of the body. And I've been a slow learner in all these years of practice, but one of the huge lessons that I kind of grew on me was the tremendous importance of being in your body, be connected to your body. The body, being connected to your body, being mindful of your body is a great protection. It's a great place of safety. It's a great place of learning. There's so much to pick up and learn by being sensitive to what goes on in your body. Not least because your mind and body are not so separate. And it's one of the avenues into understanding what goes on in your inner life is through picking up how it's expressed, how it manifests itself in the body. And as you care for your body and pay attention to it, that also then is a channel that goes back to the mind, to the inner life, and can help clarify that as well. So a huge part of this is mindfulness of the body. Mindfulness of feelings, is not emotions, but rather is what's the feeling tone of our experience. And it's closely connected to the movement of the mind of want, of liking and not liking. It's said to be pleasant. There's three primary tones of experience. The experience can be either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. But it's very closely connected to liking and not liking, or wanting and not wanting, because we often like and not like something based on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And so that area of our life, to notice when things are pleasant or unpleasant, notice how we get caught because of it, is considered a very important part of this process. And then our mind state, you know, the state of our mind, or the word citta could also be called heart. The state of our heart is, I like to kind of refer to it as the quality of our heart, or the quality of our mind. And it's probably one of the most important, precious aspects of our being, is the quality of our inner life. And to learn how to notice and pay attention to that quality of inner life is part of the process of becoming free. It's very helpful and useful. That's the third foundation. And then the fourth foundation of the truths, it's not abstract truths, like the true nature of reality, but rather the truths that are interesting here are those truths which eat the truth about those things that keep us stuck. So we see the various ways in which we get caught, we get attached and suffer, and the truths about those things that help us get unstuck. That's, you know, if the purpose is to be unstuck, to be free, those kinds of truths are the kind of truths that are useful. So these are the four areas, domains, of the four foundations of mindfulness. As the text goes through the four and discusses this, there's a refrain that discusses where this leads. If you practice these four foundations of mindfulness, it leads to certain things. And one of the things it leads to is, I think, a beautiful expression. It says, it leads to, one abides independent, clinging to nothing in the world. One abides independent, clinging to nothing in the world. And I love this word abide, dwell, abide, because, here in the modern world, we have this distinction between being and doing, and in some spiritual circles, heaven forbid that you do something. You're supposed to just be, and that's the point. But in the comparable kind of distinction, in the ancient world, would be becoming. Doing something to become something, to create something, to shape something, to do something, versus abiding. So you learn to abide. And so abide independent. So it's a independent means you're not dependent anymore. And I'm kind of fond of just shamelessly referring to the idea of, you know, codependency. You know, we now recognize psychologically that people, you know, are problematic if people become codependent. If they're overly kind of connected to each other. In order to have a healthy relationship between two people, they can't be codependent. They have to, in a certain kind of way, to be independent. And in independence, they can rejoin or reconnect in a deep, close, intimate way. But something, some kind of intimacy or depth of connection cannot happen when people are codependent. So the same thing, I think, with the rest of our life. If we're dependent on things in our life, if we're caught and needing things to be a certain way, we can't really meet our world fully. To be independent doesn't mean that we become aloof, but I think it makes us kind of capable of being connected to the world and responsible for the world in a much better way than if we're entangled with it. So part of this process of mindfulness is a process that leads us to abiding independent, not clinging to anything in the world, not caught up in anything in the world. But in order to do that, we have to understand how we get caught. We have to understand how we cling. The word abiding, I think, is particularly interesting because it's not a doing. It's kind of a resting. It's kind of like just a state of being, kind of. And that gets more interesting because nowhere, you know, we're in a mindfulness tradition. Some of you have been around these scenes in America for years and years and years and listened to these teachings and of mindfulness from people like me. And I think the impression, or the way it's taught here in the West often, is that mindfulness is something you do. You practice mindfulness, you apply your mindfulness, you direct your mindfulness, you should be mindful. But in the teachings of the Buddha, it's, as far as I can tell, he never gives anybody instructions to be mindful, to do mindfulness. Mindfulness is never an activity that a person does, but rather mindfulness is a state that one abides in. One abides in mindfulness, is the expression. So you abide in the state of attentiveness, abide in a state of awareness, abide in a state clear awareness, clear attentiveness, as opposed to doing mindfulness. And, you know, so we have a capacity, if we don't do so much, if we don't complicate stuff, the mind has a capacity to be luminously aware, to be aware, clearly aware, to be open and aware, to not have any clouds in it, not have any smog in it, to just be like the clear air or the clear water. The mind has capacity to be relaxed. And what happens in the world is clearly known, or known clearly enough, in this relaxed state of awareness. We don't have to do something. If you're relaxed and not caught up, if you're not complicating the situation, and you're not falling asleep, you're going to be aware. It's kind of hard not to. There's this wonderful exercise that some people give, where they give people the instructions: stop being aware. And most people have a very hard time following that instruction. Stop being aware, you know, because awareness is kind of the thing that the mind does. So the expression in the ancient world, ancient Buddhist teachings, is one abides in mindfulness. That's the kind of, and then in abiding in mindfulness, one learns to abide independent, free from clinging. The way to abide in this clarity of mindfulness is, according to the ancient text, is not to be mindful, but is to clearly know what is happening. And the knowing is the active part. Now here in the West, when we talk about mindfulness, mindfulness, knowing, awareness, they're all kind of almost treated as synonymous. So this is basically how people often practice here. They're practicing knowing. But I think it's significant, the distinction between abiding in a state of awareness on one hand and the ability to actively know and recognize what's happening on the other hand. Because these two movements are working hand in hand. On one hand, we're clearly trying to recognize and see what's happening here. What is this? What is my experience now? Right now I'm feeling, happy, I'm feeling grumpy. Right now I'm feeling achy. Right now I'm feeling relaxed and soft. Right now I feel I'm in a hurry. Right now I'm impatient. The line for lunch is too long. The line for cleaning your supper dishes is too long. And so you feel a certain kind of thing. And so what is this? What is this? And there's something, I think it's really powerful about not going along with what the mind is doing, but rather look and say, what is going on here? Because as soon as you say, what is going on, you change the ecosystem. You're no longer caught or involved and tied up in it. You're not being carried along or being pulled by the nose by your feelings and desires. But you're saying, what is this? And you kind of step back and look. And that stepping back and looking is a place where independence begins, freedom begins. And so the idea of looking or investigating or trying to recognize or knowing more helps us to see clearly what's happening better. But it also, just the very movement of asking or looking, what's going on here, is a step towards independence in and of itself. Even if you don't understand what you're trying to see, the fact that you're trying to makes you a little bit independent and free, a place of independence. So in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the most common verb that's used for the practice there is to know. One knows what one's feeling. One knows what the mind state is. One knows. And so this is what we come back to. We come back to knowing. So this is the active part. But then there's also, I don't know if passive is the right balance to that, receptive, or there's the doing thing, and then there's the abiding. And the abiding part is the awareness, the capacity to rest in awareness, to sit back in awareness, to allow awareness to do its thing. And this idea of allowing is very helpful, because if it's only about doing, it's a little bit tiring to always be doing. But if you only abide, your abiding probably won't become very stable. And what I've learned is this wonderful balance of those two, both to know what's happening as it's happening, and in knowing it, remembering to stay relaxed, stay open, stay somehow receptive, or allow the natural capacity of the mind to be aware, to know, to do its knowing. And sometimes the pendulum swings. Sometimes the emphasis is more on knowing and investigating, and sometimes it's more emphasis is more less doing, just open awareness, and just resting and abiding in the knowing state, the aware state. The word that I kind of in my mind bridges these two, the knowing and the abiding in mindfulness, is the word awake. We're looking to be awake. And so another question to ask as you go about your days here is, what would it be like to be awake now? Not awake because you're sleepy, but to wake up to this experience now. And the experience to wake up, the expression to wake up, to be awake to what's happening, I like, because when you wake up to what's going on, you just see it more clearly. You're not necessarily changing it or fixing it or making it go away or holding on to it. You just see it in some kind of heightened, clear state. And so this question, what does it mean to be awake right now? As opposed to, what is it like to, to have a better meditation? What is it like to be awake? And also, I like the word awake because it also bridges this word, or overlaps with this word, independent, to be independent, to abide independent, clinging to nothing in the world. So I'll tell a story. In the time of the Buddha, a story he told, kind of like a fable. And the fable had to do with a crow. No, I think it was a crow, or some kind of bird of prey. I think it was an eagle. Let's say it's an eagle, probably makes more sense. Eagle. And then a little quail. And the quail was out about, roaming around, and this eagle or hawk came down and swept down and grabbed it, because it looked like good food, and was carrying it up in its talons, you know, flying away. And the quail said, "You know something? If I'd been in my home territory, you wouldn't have caught me." And the hawk said, a little bit arrogant, I guess, and confident in itself, and said, "Oh yeah, I could have caught you anywhere." So the quail said, "Why don't you put me back in my home territory, and we'll see." And so his home territory was a plowed field, you know, so with all these clods of turned soil, so a big plowed field. And so a plowed field, you know, there's no cover, you know, it's just anywhere. So the hawk lowered, put the quail down, and flew up in the air, and the quail stood on top of one of those clods of that turned over dirt on the field, farmer's field, and the hawk probably couldn't believe it's good luck, it was going to have dinner. So it came swooping down to grab, a second time, grab that quail, and came swooping down, and the quail looked up, and just before the hawk was going to grab it, the quail jumped behind that clod of dirt. And the hawk couldn't stop fast enough and crashed into the clod of dirt and died. So it's a terrible story to tell on retreat. I apologize, but you know, it's these ancient stories. So the Buddha used the story, I believe, to say that if you stay in your home territory, you'll be safe. Nothing can get you. Nothing can grab you. And then he said that your home territory is the four foundations of mindfulness. If you can stay closely in touch with mindfulness of your body, be connected to what's going on, if you can be in touch with your feelings as they occur, if you can be in touch with your mind states as they occur, if you can be in touch with these truths as they occur, then you'll be safe. Then you'll be independent. Then you won't cling to anything. No hawk's going to grab you. And the hawk that's going to grab you is, of course, not some external hawk, but is those talons that you have of clinging and aversion and resistance that we have. So we sit here to discover ourselves, to see what's going on. As we discover ourselves, we start discovering how we make things more complicated than they need to be. How we get caught, how we get resistance, how we have desires, and how we get caught in wanting and not wanting, expectations, a sense of self, a tremendous amount of ideas of what should happen, shouldn't happen, what I need and what I don't need, our preferences. We get pulled left and right by how we're feeling physically, how we're feeling, the feeling tones we have, the mental state we have. It's often those kind of run the show for us because we're not independent from them. We're kind of caught in them. But if you're really mindful of them, if you really understand them and see them, understand how all this works, then slowly we learn how to be independent and free, and this beautiful process of becoming free. And I believe it's one of the most beautiful and profound things a person can do is to become independent, not clinging to anything in the world, to become free, to become liberated, to become awake in this way. So as we go through this retreat, Max and I will give some talks on these Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Max will give a talk tomorrow on mindfulness of the body. And for your part, you might want to experiment a little bit or try out a number of these things I've said today. You might try out the practice of understanding. What's going on here? Not just to understand what's there. Don't strain to, it's like you have to understand what's there. But try to understand what's happening any moment. What's happening right now? But see if you can, while you're doing that, see, it isn't just a matter of understanding, but it's also a matter of appreciating the quality of attention, the quality of mind or heart that's doing the understanding, that's open to understand, that's receptive to it. That's as important as what you come to understand. And it's a beautiful capacity, you know, to understand, to want to understand, to search to understand. What is this? What happens in the mind when you simply, in a very simple, easy way, go, what is this? What is this breath? What is this in-breath? Even if you don't understand the in-breath better, just that movement, what is this? And then that movement of maybe it's a little bit of freedom or lightness or openness or something that's a little wakefulness. So what is that? Experiment with that. Look at that. And what does it mean, this teaching that, you know, it's kind of a challenging thing, I think, to hear after all these years of mindfulness, some of you, that the Buddha didn't instruct anyone to be mindful. Isn't that amazing? It's kind of shocking, isn't it? But rather, he talked about abiding in mindfulness. And what is this abiding is? If awareness or mindfulness or attentiveness is a natural capacity of the mind that doesn't have to be prompted, doesn't have to be intended, doesn't have to be made to happen, what is this? What is it? What is it? What is this innate or natural capacity of the mind? How do we touch into it? How do we allow for it? Can you feel your way into it? Can you kind of, what is it? What is it that, what kind of awareness is there? What kind of awareness operates that you don't have to try to be aware? You mostly have to untry everything else. Mostly have to let go and relax and open to it, allow for it. And how does that support the practice of, what is this? Getting to know what's happening better. Discovery. So, that is what I had in mind for today. It's the introduction for the talks this week. Does anyone have any questions you'd like to ask at this point? Anything at all that you'd like to ask about? Yes, please.
The different flavors of those.
Uh-huh. The balance of it. You know, and there's so many things to be said, but what comes to mind first is abiding in awareness. It happens without any self-referencing. There's no self there. No self in the sense of something you point to and, you know, like that's me. It's not happening to anybody else, but you know, you can't point to something that's, this is me. And so there's a feeling of, if people who are, which everyone I think at some point are, you know, kind of caught up in self and me, myself and mine and self-identity and what's in it for me, and so many references to self that go on. You know, most of what people think about is self-referential. It's kind of amazing. And as I say in my intro class that I teach, it's probably the reason why we stay so interested in what we think about. It's so repetitive, most of us. And if anybody else talked as much to us as and said the same things as we say to ourselves, we would wonder about their mental health. But, you know, it's kind of, we don't doubt our own mental health, usually. And, you know, it's perfectly normal to think about the same thing over and over again. And I think my theory is that the reason is that it keeps our interest is it's usually about us, about ourselves. So, but in this abiding and awareness, there's no self there. It's like in the, you know, in the clear air, there's nothing there to point to because it's, you know, it's, you can't see it, it's just there. As soon as there's a bird flying, you can point to the bird. So, whereas in knowing as a practice, you know, you apply yourself to know and to see more clearly, that it's one of the dangers of that is that because it's intentional, is that it brings along like a little magnet sometimes all the ideas of what it, you know, I'm the one who's doing it. And all the associations that are there together with being the one who's doing something. One of the associations is I have to be successful in what I do. And that's going to trip you up. Or some people, their idea is that some people associate doing with it's a drag. I should just deserve to be enlightened. You know, and entitled to be enlightened, it shouldn't require any work. It's an imposition to do anything. Some people, they're constantly measuring themselves. You know, how am I doing? Am I measuring up? I did a in my early period of Buddhist meditation practice on retreat. I was kind of often caught up in comparing myself to other people on the retreat. You know, am I doing it as well as they are? Am I doing as well? Or sometimes the conceit was, I'm doing it better than them. You know, it's embarrassing to say, but, you know. So this idea of the intentional part of practice can lend itself to get caught up in all kinds of ways. So part of the function of mindfulness or this knowing practice, seeing clearly what's going on, is to start noticing how we make it more complicated it needs to be. The effort, the intentional effort we make, that we're adding too many things, agendas in it. And slowly over time is to simplify it. So it becomes a very simple. Just what is this? And as it becomes simpler and simpler, the more easeful or natural way in which abiding occurs kind of almost merges with the knowing. They don't become really so separate anymore. It's almost like the natural functioning of the mind is to know. It no longer needs to be intentional to do that. So is that adequate as an answer? Or good enough? Or you want to ask more? Or? No? Yes, Lee? Say, Lala?
I think that's
a retreat baby.
A retreat baby here now.
Uh-huh.
As I look at her, she's simply abiding in awareness. She's just so really simple. It's part of the attraction for me to be with a being.
Mm.
It's just being. And doesn't have the words or the cognitive power to believe in something she has. And so just kind of, what is this?
Uh-huh. So it could
not even a question.
So that, I think having that as a reference point could be very meaningful in terms of getting a sense of how to do it yourself. Just to see that certain kind of purity in a baby can do that. And it's not going to last. We all need to practice sooner or later. Okay, so last thing is a kind of an announcement. that, to be honest, it feels a little bit awkward to say, but we would like to request a different practice or custom here at IRC. That been a lot of discussion in different circles for some time. Some centers have adopted it, and Andrea Fell and I have talked about it. We'd like to do it here. And that is that when at the end of a Dharma talk or end of the instructional sit in the morning, if the teachers could leave first. And then, you know, practically it's nice because we have important things to do. You know, interviews to get to, bathrooms to get to, and so just makes the whole thing a little bit easier. But also I think there's something very meaningful about expresses a certain kind of respect. And, you know, and that's why it's a little awkward. I don't necessarily want any more respect than I get. But I think it's just, independent of me, I think it's just a good idea. I think it's helpful overall and healthy thing to overall have a certain level of respect to the teachings or to the teachers in the abstract or something. So so that's what I'd like to ask of you, if you're willing to do that. It's a little different than our custom. And then we can see what that's like. We can ask, what is this like? What's happening here? And then some of you might want to tell us later what it was like to do that and see if the experiment is a meaningful one, a useful one. So let's, it's nice at the end of a sitting, end of a talk, to sit for a minute or something as a way of regathering, reconnecting.